The Way Out Podcast, episode 83.
I've been really diving into my recovery by just listening to different stories and taking away so many similarities with so many paths that everyone's taking. So it's huge for my recovery. It would never even cross my mind that this world existed until I reached out. I just went and had a conversation with him because he had what I wanted. Then I was immediately rudely awakened to how big this community really is, and it only has grown from there.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us on this week's installment of The Way Out, sharing stories from people just like you who have recovered from alcoholism and other addictions. The Way Out does not speak on behalf of, nor are we affiliated with, any 12-step organization. Our purpose is to share with you, one episode at a time, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The Way Out Podcast is sponsored by Transitions Daily. Would you like to join a free, anonymous, online group that offers a daily topic email with popular recovery resources accompanied by a secret Facebook group for discussion? Go to dailyaaemails.com for more information about Transitions Daily. Don't forget to share dailyaaemails.com with friends, in meetings, and with sponsees in recovery. Make sure to check out the official website of The Way Out Podcast at www.wayoutcast.com. There you will find links to our latest episodes on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Radio FM. You can also follow The Way Out Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Help us get the message out that lifelong recovery from alcoholism and addiction is possible by giving us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast.
The Way Out Podcast is on right now. I'm Charlie, and I'm thrilled to bring you part one of Eric's story, a story you'll only find here on The Way Out Podcast. Eric has an amazing story to share, and I found myself identifying with so many of the feelings, thought patterns, and behaviors Eric relates as he recounts his journey to recovery, and I know you will too. Listen up. Eric, welcome to The Way Out Podcast. I can't thank you enough for reaching out to me and taking some time out of your schedule to join us and share your story.
Absolutely. It's an honor to come on the podcast, and I've been really diving into my recovery by just listening to different stories and taking away so many similarities with so many paths that everyone's taking. So it's huge for my recovery.
I'm glad you said that, Eric, in terms of the stories, and that's exactly how we connect. It's exactly how we relate. I realize that I'm not alone when I listen to another person's story, really listen to it, and I connect to that story. And then I understand once again that I'm not the only one that feels like I feel. I'm not the only one that thinks the way I think. And I'm not the only one that's done what I've done, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I always thought it was it would never even cross my mind that this world existed until I reached out to an AA member, he was a father of some guys that I grew up with, and it was kind of about this time last year, and I just went and had a conversation with him because he had what I wanted, and he introduced me to AA, and I went to my first AA meeting the next day with him, and then I was immediately rudely awakened to how big this community really is, and it only has grown from there.
It's such an amazing thing that you just said there, Eric, which is, I met him, he had what I wanted, and so then that was the beginning of seeing some hope, right? That maybe there was a way out of your current predicament. So let's talk about a little bit. Let's reset a little bit and share with the Way Out Podcast audience. How you came up. You know, you live in Canada. Where in Canada do you live?
I live in a small town, about an hour and a half east of Calgary.
Okay, are you a big Calgary Flames guy then?
I'm more of a Vancouver Canucks fan.
So. Oh my God, that probably doesn't sit real well with your neighbors.
Yes, it's either Edmonton Oilers fans or Calgary Flames fans.
Not a lot of Canucks fans around you.
No.
I'm a big Minnesota Wild guy, so that's our deal here in Minnesota, is the Minnesota Wild.
Yes, I grew up with some people that were Minnesota North Star fans.
Oh, too, so. Man, that's a painful, painful, painful topic for us in Minnesota. That's a painful topic. Yes, our beloved North Stars got ripped away from us and moved to Dallas. So tell me a little bit about growing up and what it was like coming up near Calgary, small town. How many people lived in your town, Eric?
About 8,000 people.
Okay, all right. That is small, man. And so a lot of people knew everybody, right? Like that kind of dynamic involved. Yeah,
you couldn't get away with anything. Everybody knew everybody's business, and everybody, there was a million different versions of a story, and it was always how to maintain an image. So it was, you couldn't run and hide from something bad you did. Everything you did, everybody knew about, so.
And when was what was family like, life like growing up? Did you have a relatively quote unquote normal upbringing from a family perspective?
Well, I thought it was normal, but then looking back in retrospect, I'm starting to see a lot of the chaos that was there. Both of my grandpas were both alcoholic.
Sure.
One on my dad's side, he got sober a long time ago, and he stayed sober. But my other grandpa and on my mom's side, he drank until he passed away. And it was the culture in my family was there was always drinks, and it was there was it didn't matter what was happening, if it was a dinner, if it was we're camping, if it was we're working in the field, it was there was always beer around. And And I'm starting to remember, have all these memories of the not so normal, what I thought was normal, but not normal for non-alcoholic families. For example, my grandpa passing out at the supper table, or me being 10 years old and driving my dad's truck and him back from a field from working with cows. And it like all these things that stood out to me as such a normal life start to really crush the perfect image of what your family was into, this is a mess.
Yeah, that there was serious dysfunction and some alcoholism in your family, and until we sort of come out of that sort of family bubble, we're not always aware that this is something that isn't particularly normal or healthy.
Yeah, exactly. Like being a 9-year-old kid getting in the truck with your grandpa and he gets you to blow in the blow box for you so he can start his truck.
Yeah, that's sort of like, you might be an alcoholic if you have to get your 9-year-old grandson to blow into the blow box to get the ignition to go.
Yeah, so it's I'm starting to realize all these preconditioned cultural aspects on why drinking was just secondhand nature. So it gets me into that point where I was uncomfortable. I always seemed uncomfortable in crowds. I was very unsure of myself. Mm-hmm. So then all of a sudden it became, I either put my ego out, and then when I became and found alcohol, then that became a huge tool and coping mechanism to break out of my shell.
Oh, man, I can relate to that, Eric. That feeling that we just don't quite feel right being us, and we're just quite not good enough as we are, and feeling vulnerable and feeling like we don't stack up to the rest. And when was the first time you drank?
there's a handful of different, I call them different experiences with alcohol. My first taste of alcohol where I had more than a sip. I remember being very young, 5, 6, 7, and we were out by the combine. And of course, having uncles and a dad and a grandpa who were all about drinking, you think they had a water bottle for the kids? No. So they said, stop whining and have a drink of this. And sure. I took a couple real big chugs of beer. And I remember how good it tasted. That just like, wow, that tastes really good. And then later on, I was probably about 10. My mom was back at work. I was with my brother and my sister. And I knew that she had alcohol in the cupboard. So I went in and I took a couple swigs, tasted gross, went outside, felt the buzz. And I said, I like that beer.
Yeah.
So what do you think I did?
Yeah.
I went right back inside and had a couple more drinks. But I mean, it didn't really go past that. And it was never really a continuous thing. And then where I get to later, it's the night before my 13th birthday. Two of my friends knock on the door at my house in town and they see come outside. I come outside. They're like, look, we got some coolers and some beer. And I'm like, oh, I have a good idea. And then I went back inside, grabbed three of my dad's beers. And then I said, we're going to the movie. So we wandered around town and the three of us drank all our drinks. And my mom gave me money for the movie. And of course, I didn't go to the movie. We went to some liquor store and got somebody to buy us some rye. And we continued to drink the rest of that. And I distinctly remember drinking it, getting drunk, and wanting more. And the three of us drank it until we didn't have any more alcohol. And the next day, we go out to the ranch and it's a branding and it's where you brand the calves and castrate them and all that. And that was my experience with my first hangover.
Ooh.
Was burnt hair and castrating.
Oh, brother, that's a tough morning. That's a tough morning to endure your first, you know, sort of your virgin hangover and having to endure the aroma of a cow being branded. Were you able to hold down whatever was in your stomach?
Yeah, and that's when I realized, and all of a sudden these messages come, is that it doesn't, were my parents and my uncles and my grandpa, it doesn't matter what you did the night before, as long as you get up and go to work and get your job done, nothing matters.
Ah, yes, as long as I'm functioning, I get to be an alcoholic, right?
Exactly.
As long as I am meeting the minimum requirements, right, and I drag my ass out of bed and do what I need to do, right? I don't have to be happy. I could be a grumpy son of a bitch, but if I do what I have to do, then my reward is alcohol.
Yeah, and then I realized how that became my common theme throughout my the rest of my drinking and using career.
Did you, Eric, if you were like me, I felt the same way. Like, look, I hold down a job, I pay my bills, and I earned this. I earned the right to be able to drink how I want to drink, right? Did you feel like that?
Exactly. It's like, I can do this because I have a job, I have a mortgage, I have a family, I have this, I have that, and, right. and it's not affecting me.
Right.
It's not taking anything away.
Right.
But it was.
Absolutely.
It gets worse.
Absolutely, man. But we don't see that in the beginning. We see all the things that alcohol is doing for us, right?
Yeah.
But what we don't see is what it's stripping from us and what it's taking from us and what it is robbing us of and robbing the people in our lives of. We don't see that, especially in the beginning, right? So you have this sort of experience with alcohol. You get drunk, and all you can think about at that point is, man, I wanted to drink as much as I possibly could. I ran out. How does your drinking manifest itself in your life from that point at such a young age, 13 years old?
So from there, it became a manageability thing where I don't want to get in trouble and I don't want other parents and friends and the school to think I'm a bad kid. I don't want to be labeled as that group.
Sure.
So I would manage it and only do it in certain times and when the opportunity arose, then I would. And then this is where I recognize where my drinking wasn't like everybody else's, because we went out trick-or-treating. I think I was 14. And it was a nice day out. I got my drinks, and I drank so much I just puked all over the McDonald's bathroom. And then all the other kids thought it was hilarious. The girls thought it was hilarious. Everybody thought it was so cool and so proud, or like this notch of social status.
Oh, yeah. There's like a badge of honor. Like, you are, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So all of a sudden you get into that grade 14, 15, and I go to this party, and I drank so much. I was incoherent and just dry heaves and puking. And the dad of the girl that had the party drove me to my parents' house. And everyone was laughing, oh, it happens to us all. And I continued to puke and shit and everything for hours on end. And then the next day I woke up and I had black stomach bile, blood or whatever, all over my pillow and in my hairs, and the level of alcohol poisoning that I must have been going through that night must have been like bad.
Absolutely. Right? Wow. And you know, the scary thing is that you have a bunch of people around you at that point in your life that are minimizing this, right? That are only minimizing but glorifying it.
My punishment was I had to get out of bed and do the dishes. And I was so sick that day that I couldn't take three steps without stopping. Not because I was worried I was going to puke, because I was in so much physical pain that I was like, I couldn't even move.
Wow.
And then
Wow.
That night, I played a hockey game. And I was on a team with grade 12, 11, and 10 students, and I was one of the youngest guys on the team. And I was really sick and pale and wasn't playing very good. And some of the other guys are like, what's wrong with you? And my dad was actually coaching. He's like, well, he got pissed last night. And then all of a sudden, boom, there's the badge of honor from all the seniors and the older guys. And all of a sudden, I was accepted, and they're inviting me to parties. They're inviting me to grad parties. Then all of a sudden, this whole new world of social popularity with all these older guys and older girls just blossomed out of this, like, traumatic event that should have deterred me from drinking. But from then on, I was a regular drinker.
So you had this badge of honor that allowed you to be able to sort of rise in social status, and that badge of honor was earned through nearly dying of alcohol poisoning.
Exactly.
Amazing. And, you know, I have a similar story and a similar experience, brother. I have, and I wore it like a badge of honor, I had drank so much that my heart stopped and my lips were blue and I wasn't breathing and somehow got revived, right? But I blacked out, so I don't remember any of this. And I am a fucking god, right? Like, I am a party legend at that point. And boy, man, did I use that to my advantage, right? Like, yeah, I've arrived now, right? I am absolutely, I can absolutely identify. So you are in a point where, what happens after this experience, and how soon afterwards did you, I mean, you're puking up blood, right? Coughing up blood, and you can't hardly move. when does the thought enter your brain that it's okay to drink again?
It must have been either the next day or the next weekend, because then it was like just that overwhelming sense of acceptance just overtook all the pain. And then it was like that part of Dazed and Confused when they go and pick up the kid from his house and they take him to the party, right?
Right.
And it was like all of a sudden that's happening to me. I don't have my license yet, and these guys are phoning and asking if I want to come to the party with them, and they pick me up and I go with these 17 and 18-year-old guys.
This week's Recovery Revealed segment is brought to you by All Recovery Rings and allrecoveryrings.com. Would you like a medallion or coin from your favorite recovery program, hand-forged into a beautiful ring? Go to allrecoveryrings.com and choose from over 15 stunning styles, all hand-forged by expert craftsmen. What are you waiting for? Do like I did and get your very own recovery ring today. We'll be back to Eric's story straight away. But first, let's break for this week's Recovery Revealed, an opportunity to take a closer look at a particular aspect of recovery. Self-care is a tremendously important part of achieving quality and meaningful sobriety. For years, I abused my body by assaulting it with drugs and alcohol. I inflicted chronic sleep deprivation and rotated between chronic under-eating to at times overeating, unable to achieve anything resembling balance with regard to my diet. Exercise was inconsistent at best and flat out non-existent most of the time. In the end, addiction totally supplanted food, sleep, exercise, and social interaction, which individually would take a toll on anyone. But the lack of the whole lot of them in my life spelled misery with a capital M. Getting my fix was the priority, and the physical and emotional needs of my own, and indeed others in my life, took a back seat. Is self-care in sobriety being selfish? The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous clearly states that selfishness, self-centeredness, is the root of our troubles. So how then can we practice self-care without being selfish? They appear at first blush to be mutually exclusive. The reality, however, is that self-care is not an act of self-centered behavior. Self-care can be defined as any activity that we deliberately do in order to take care of our emotional, mental, physical, and spiritual health. Selfishness is defined as a person lacking consideration for others, concerned chiefly with one's own personal profit or pleasure. I certainly was given the opportunity to understand that I often reveled in pursuits of personal pleasure and profit at the expense of not only others, but myself as well, in active addiction and alcoholism. The importance of self-care in sobriety cannot be understated. If you're new to recovery, or if you find yourself in the familiar camp of feeling like a part of you has been neglected, you're not alone. Self-care doesn't come natural for many of us in recovery, as we were apt to be quite neglectful to our own needs while we were mired in our addiction. Self-care can really be broken out into four primary categories: physical, emotional, spiritual, and social. Here are some suggestions for each category, which will allow you to identify a few ways you might be able to improve your overall self-care habits and ultimately improve your overall well-being. Physical self-care involves activities that improve your physical health, including diet and exercise. Moving your body is important, whether it is through structured sport or exercise, or through entertainment like dancing or going on a hike. Feed your body healthy foods with high nutritional value on a daily basis, and get plenty of sleep. Go to the doctor when you are sick and get rest when you need it. Mental and emotional self-care involves practices that maintain your mental strength and emotional health. Developing reasonable expectations of yourself is an important part of mental and emotional health. Your goal should be to stretch yourself, not break yourself. Learning to be more accepting, kind, and forgiving of yourself can reduce stress and anxiety, and can create a generally more balanced lifestyle. you may need to remove some shoulds from your vocabulary or say no to requests from time to time. Focus on improving and expanding your social supports and create friendships with people who respect you and don't expect you to do all of the work to maintain the relationship. Do a variety of things for fun and stimulation each week. Spiritual self-care involves practices that exercise your mind and soul. Spirituality can be defined in many ways, and there are a variety of activities that can improve your spiritual health. Some activities that may contribute to spiritual self-care include prayer, meditation, attending services with like-minded others, meetings for us recovering addicts, and our 12-step brothers and sisters are great for that, self-exploration and clarifying your values and priorities, reading literature and initiating meaningful discussions with others, finding a way to contribute to the well-being of others, service work, people, service work. Remember, every time you get on a plane, the flight attendants always remind you to put your own oxygen mask on before helping others with theirs. If you can't breathe, you will hardly have the ability to help someone else, yeah? Taking care of your needs exists in a balanced, steady place on the middle of a continuum, with intense selfishness on the one end and extreme sacrificing what you need or want for others' sake on the other end. Nurturing oneself is a key factor in being able to maintain strength, resolve, motivation, and inner resources to continue to give to others. In fact, doing too much for others could deprive them of the opportunity to learn how to provide their own self-care. Now back to my interview with Eric. Listen up.
Don't forget, the way we get the message out to those who still suffer is to give this podcast a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform.
So it was basically a weekend warrior. Whenever there was parties, there was always a party. And if there wasn't a party, then it would be a group of us that would go hang out at somebody's house. So it was always something like that. And that's around the time when I started to smoke weed too. So you'd be go and smoke a bunch of joints and drink a bunch of beer and play video games, or go to a party and get obliterated and shotgun beer. Like, it was like everything that we did for entertainment always revolved around drugs and alcohol.
Yeah. And you're feeling pretty great right about now, because you're in the crowd. So does your drinking continue to be sort of as often as you can? I know that, you know, for at least for me, when I was that age, it was not always, alcohol wasn't super readily available, right? So you sort of just took advantage of it when it was available. Was it like that for you?
Yeah, so I had a job, and so I had some disposable income. And so it was basically a weekend warrior whenever there was parties.
Right.
And usually, for some reason, the culture was there was always a party. And if there wasn't a party, then it would be a group of us that would go hang out at somebody's house. So it was always something like that. And that's around the time when I started to smoke weed too. So you'd be go and smoke a bunch of joints and drink a bunch of beer and play video games, or go to a party and get obliterated and shotgun beer. Like, it was like everything that we did for entertainment always revolved around drugs and alcohol.
You're telling my story, brother. You're telling my story. Absolutely. 100%. It was all about the party lifestyle back in high school, and it absolutely 100% of the time always involved pot and alcohol. Did it transition at some point for you, Eric, where it was not, where you started doing it even when you weren't partying and even when you weren't with a bunch of friends?
I think since I had like a relative knowledge of alcoholism, and I'm saying I'm not going to be that.
Mm-hmm.
I always had that line where, even though I want to, I'm not going to do that, and I'm going to prove it to myself that I am not that, because I'm not doing it. But in the meantime, looking back, I realized that if I was being honest with myself, I probably wanted to.
So you had this thing in your head that said, look, this is a line I can't cross. And I can't cross it because I know, I've seen that, I've seen this tape play out, and I'm not going to be that person. I'm not going to be grandpa. I'm not going to be so-and-so, right? I'm not going to be Uncle Jimmy. So you draw that line. In retrospect, do you look back at the times when you did drink that you drank more than other people?
Oh, yeah. I was definitely the one of the ones, and that's where I gravitated to a group of friends where that would drink like that. And then it made it feel normal because you weren't the only one drinking like that. But when I look back, if it was a party of 50 people or 100 people, there's only a handful of us that are really drinking like that.
That's correct. That is correct. Yes. Though I tell myself, right, that, but it's clear as day that there's only a handful of us that are really, really the binge drinkers, right? And I was absolutely a binge drinker when I was a teenager. Do you relate to that binge and then I'm not going to do it for a while, you know, and then binge and that type of experience?
Oh, absolutely. Like it would be just a full drink until you pass out and then feel like garbage all day Sunday, do nothing. And then by Wednesday, oh, I feel pretty good. And then exactly. Friday comes around and you do it all over again.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. When does your drinking at some point, so you come out of high school, do you go to college, do you get a job, what happens after high school?
So out of high school, that's around the time we're 16, I was going to go, grade 11, I was going to go to university, but that's about the time where drinking was really starting. I never, looking back, obviously it was affecting me, but it was definitely starting to affect my marks and obviously this is about the time when hard drugs started to slip in. And then I said, you know what? Alberta is an oil and gas industry. I know I can get a job the day after high school. And a junior team wants me to come play hockey with them. So I'm going to go play hockey, get a job in the oil field, and live the dream. Have money, play hockey, and party. And that's what I did for 2 years after high school.
So you join a junior hockey team, you're living really the good life, right? Get a job in the oil and gas industry, and you're but drinking is still very much at the center. Does the frequency of your drinking pick up at that point?
Yeah, it definitely did. Then all of a sudden it became, I had enough money, I could go to the bar on a more regular basis, and I could go and go on a Wednesday night for wing night. And stay till 2 a.m. and then go to work the next day hungover. And then all of a sudden it's not just a Friday, Saturday night routine anymore. Now it's a Friday, Saturday, fun day, Sundays, maybe a Wednesday night and a Thursday night. And it's becoming a regular occurrence all the time. And where I'm phoning people, hey, let's go do this tonight. Hey, let's go do that tonight. And that's like that silent voice inside your head that goes, how come they don't want to come drink with me? How come?
right. Yes. So you start increasing that frequency. Do you at some point, you know, for me, I know I realized that I couldn't drink like I wanted to drink increasingly as I got older in my 20s with other people. Did you have that experience?
I found that to a point where I would start to realize that I got too drunk and I would embarrass myself. Mm. And then I'd be like, okay. Then all of a sudden it becomes that shame, guilt, remorse. Mm. And then we drink about it later. But it became a point where I thought it was funny when other people did that, but I did not think it was funny when I did that.
Yeah.
And and this is about the time too where alcohol, I was never the type of drunk that would drink and then could drink till 6 a.m. and just continually to drink beers and stay up all night and have fun. I got tired. And I would pass out usually before I blacked out. So at about 16, that's when I tried MDMA and I tried some cocaine. And then I realized, oh, this cocktail of drugs and alcohol makes me a lot more it seemed like I was more under control in my mind, but it definitely was not.
It was really the opposite. But now you're starting to introduce these sort of, you know, Molotov cocktails of drugs and alcohol that increase your ability to be able to consume more alcohol without passing out, right? And gives you the illusion of control because I'm introducing a stimulant, right, along with a depressant. And do you have any sort of, you know, moments of clarity along that line that, you know, things might be starting to get a little out of hand?
I honestly thought that everything was under control. And then when I was 23, I had a vehicle accident, obviously drunk from driving. Mm. And I rolled my truck and I fractured my skull and got air ambulance to a hospital, and I was in a coma for a week.
Oh, wow.
So, like, it was the drinking and driving and like, that just everything. When I was in it, it seemed normal. But looking back, it was just like, oh, that is, it's just, like.
Brother, that is, like, wow. That is absolutely crazy that, that you survived something like that, right? Mm. At 23 years of age now. And you end up in the hospital in a coma for a week. And when you come out of that coma, what are the first thoughts? What goes through your mind the first time you wake up?
I was pretty depressed and pretty sad. And I was really worried that I had hurt somebody else.
I bet.
But then I found out it was just myself, and I just rolled it and didn't know, no other vehicles were involved. And I was really sick for quite a while. It took a long time to get better. And I remember within 2 weeks of getting out of the hospital, I went to a baseball tournament with my friends. And I tried to have a beer. And I wanted to have a beer so bad. And I would have one, and it would just make me sick. And then I would just go to bed. And at the time, I'm like, well, this is kind of nice because, you know, drinking was kind of playing a part in that and in my accident. So, you know, maybe it'll be good to dry out for a while. But right. To my unbeknownst knowledge, I would just continuously try. And then the next time I could have two beer. And then a week later I could have three beer. And then the next thing I know, I'm getting loaded again. So it was, and then all of a sudden it becomes, oh, when I'm drinking, it makes my head feel better. And when I'm drinking, it makes the pain go away. And then all of a sudden it becomes a self-medication, not only for my internal psychological issues, it becomes a self-medication for my physical pains.
The magic elixir that makes everything better, right? And yeah. That to me is absolutely rings true for me. I used it not only for a physical anesthetic, right, to anesthetize my physical pain, but to also relieve my, you know, my psychological, my mental anguish, my emotional sort of pain as well. So you're now convinced yourself, not only is it okay to drink again, after rolling your truck, nearly dying and being in a coma for a week, you've convinced yourself not only, or your disease has convinced you, that it's okay, not only that it's okay, but it's good, right? That it's beneficial, right? And so it's instructive of the depths that our disease can motivate us to rationalize why we need to have this in our lives.
Exactly. Like, just the, oh, I need to fit in. I'm missing out, and I'm losing something. And the grief of them, like something slipping out of your fingers. It's like, no, I don't want to let that part of me go, which, you know, later in your recovery, you go through the exact same thing. but it's a more healthier grieving process of letting that life go.
That's an interesting thing, and I love the way you said that, Eric. Because that is very normal to grieve this substance that really, for all intents and purposes, was our solution to life and our solution to the problem of us, right? And it was there for me when nothing and nobody else was, right? Like, it was reliably there for me until it took everything away, until it turned on me, until it became the reason that I had lost the ability to be able to cope with life, right? But for a long, long time, man, it was absolutely the reason I could still continue to cope with life.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, how can I let this coping mechanism go? What do I do without it? How do I survive without this?
The fear, right? There's real fear there.
Yeah, it's true. It's like losing the ability to breathe. Like, and it just scared the shit out of me. So I get to this point after the accident where I can manage this. I'm not going to drink and drive anymore. I'm going to be more responsible.
The alcohol is not the problem, right? It's not the alcohol that's the problem. It was the driving.
Exactly. It's just the insanity of it just makes me laugh.
Correct.
And even 2 years before that accident, I was at a jamboree music festival, and I was 2 a.m, and I was wasted and picked a fight with these guys, and the one guy beat me up so bad, and my face was swole shut, and then after he got off me, he kicked me in the face and knocked me out, and I still go back to that. And I go, that wasn't the alcohol that caused that. That was just, I shouldn't have said something at that point in time.
Right, exactly. It can't be the alcohol at that point. It's always something or somebody else, right? Yeah. That is the problem. But certainly it's not the alcohol. That's definitely not the problem. I can definitely keep that in my life. I just need to change. And I'm willing to change anything else but that, right?
Exactly.
So tell me how your drinking then plays out after this accident, after you discover that, yes, I still can drink again and I'm going to try to manage this. What happens?
So this is around the same time I met my wife, and she also liked to drink, and we had a party and we had a group of friends, and we'd have house parties, and there'd be dances and wedding dances, and there's ball tournaments and hockey tournaments. So there was always something going on. There was always the next party. There was always the next function. And it became a regular routine where we go out and we go have fun and we go dancing and we get drunk. And we go have fun. And then I go on hockey nights on during the week. I go to play hockey and I drink. And then but I would still drive home. But I'd say, well, I only had, you know, 4 or 5.
Right.
But I mean, right. That's like the alcoholic counting when I go, but then I had 2 or 3 before that. And then when I was at work, I had 3 or 4 at work. It's like,
yeah, I always only had a few. Just a few. How many of you had a few? Yeah. Well, that, you know, it could have been anywhere from like 4 to 12.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And so, I always convinced myself, like you did, I think, tell me if you can relate to this, that I'm not drunk. I'm just a little buzzed, right? But I'm good, right? I'm totally in control. And the reality was quite the opposite. I was drunk and driving a lot.
Yeah, exactly. I go back to a memory where I was maybe 14 and we're going to an outdoor rink and we're going to play shinny hockey, and we have one beer and I'm playing hockey and I go, I don't like how I feel playing hockey with this one beer in my system. I don't like the effects of the alcohol in my system. Right. And then I fast forward to 18, 20, 23, and I go, didn't even phase my mind that I didn't have alcohol in my system until I had the third, fourth, fifth, or sixth drink in me. And it's like how quickly it changes, A, your tolerance, or A, your acceptance on how you feel and you can function with alcohol in your system.
Absolutely. It's both probably, right? Our tolerance absolutely gets better, but our sort of psychological acceptance of how to be able to operate under the influence becomes the norm. It becomes normal to operate under the influence.
That's all the time we have for this week. Make sure to listen up next week for the second half of my interview with Eric.
Thank you for being a part of The Way Out, where we share stories from people just like you who have recovered from alcoholism and other addictions. If you would like to reach out to the show, you can visit us on the web at wayoutcast.com. That's wayoutcast, all one word, .com. Or drop your host a friendly email at share@wayoutcast.com. There you can also find links to previous episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podcast Garden. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the podcast, contact me at share@wayoutcast.com. See you next time. And remember, if you don't change, your sobriety date will.